Charlie, I'd like you to finish this thought.
Dun, 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 dun.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
That's Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And somehow you know it as well as any hit song on the Hot 100.
Yes, I do.
This year is Beethoven's 250th birthday, so there's no better time to figure out why we can't escape the symphony, a symbol of all that's good and bad in classical music as we know it. I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
And I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And we're the hosts of Switched On Pop. In our four-movement miniseries, The Fifth, we're going to explain why we still can't get the symphony out of our heads 200 years after its composition.
We're going to hear how Beethoven created a piece that totally rewrote the rules of classical composition. It was a total rock star symphony, but also explain why it became a symbol of freedom for some and exclusion for so many others.
And we're going to do it with the help of an orchestra that's been performing Beethoven's Fifth since 1842, the New York Philharmonic.
Starting on September 8th, listen to The Fifth on Switched On Pop, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Welcome to Switched On Pop. I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
And I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And Charlie, it is throwback summer. And today we are throwing back to 1964.
Way back.
Way back. To listen to a track from the Motown group Martha and the Vandellas. It's Dancing in the Street.
Sunglasses on, t-shirts on, flip-flops on, top down. Oh my gosh. I have so much that just popped up about this. Wow.
All right. All in due time, Charles. We are reaching back to this 60s Motown classic in order to unlock how this song, as you say, just like lights you up as you listen to it.
Yeah.
But also to explore the surprising history, the surprising afterlife of this song. So in the first half, we're going to break down the genesis and the magic behind Dancing in the Street. In the second half, we'll see what it became.
Ooh, cool. Okay, I'm so excited because I honestly have not listened so closely to this track. It's almost always kind of in the background on the radio or something. I didn't grow up with it, obviously. And upon just one listen, I was like, oh my gosh, I just heard so much musical history. I'm so excited to break this down. So where do you want to take us?
Good. Let's go right to the very start, to a staff songwriter at Motown, which was very much modeled in the assembly plant fashion. You know, Berry Gordy consciously was invoking Henry Ford.
Really?
At the Motown studios.
Pump them out.
So we have the staff songwriter Ivory Joe Hunter brings this tune in to a session that's kind of the bones of what we just heard, Dancing in the Street.
Yeah.
But it's different. It's melancholy. It's kind of a blues, kind of a down-tempo thing. Two other Motown stalwarts, Mickey Stevenson and Marvin Gaye.
No.
Yeah. Workshop the song
and
turn it into Dancing in the Streets.
Ooh.
Let's listen one more time. Cool. So once the team had this song in place, they needed a singer. And the singer was Martha Reeves and her backup singers, Annette Beard and Rosalind Ashford.
Oh, they're good.
They had cut a few hits for Motown, like Heat Wave. But Martha actually started as a secretary in the Motown offices.
What?
Yeah, as she was towards her big break.
Wow.
Yeah, the Vandellas took their name from a street in Detroit called Van Dyke Street. And the singer, Della Reese. Mm-hmm. Van Dyke, Della, Vandella.
Ooh.
That's how their name came together. So a very local phenomenon.
Yet becomes a national summer hit.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to see how this happens.
I mean, you get the sense that Motown was a family. I mean, in a way, Marvin Gaye, in making this song, was repaying them a favor because Martha and the Vandellas sang backup vocals on one of his first big hits, Stubborn Kind of Fellow. I mean, when you're getting that kind of vocal support, you got to pay it forward.
Absolutely. You need a lead. Yeah.
Yeah. And Gay even went so far as to play drums and percussion on Dancing in the Street.
No way. Wow.
Yeah. So this was a real family affair.
Huh.
Now, you're thinking of this song, and I think as soon as it starts, you're starting to groove.
Absolutely. Yeah. The first thing that I noticed is that underlying it is this sort of just core bass vamp that just keeps running throughout.
Yes.
I almost was like, whoa, this could be like sampled into a breakbeat and played in like modern hip hop almost. I kind of had assumed that like a lot of Motown tracks, especially of this era, were more harmonically, like a lot more harmonic movement, a lot of chordal changes. But this is like almost like proto James Brown bass vamps.
Yeah, no, this is powerful stuff. I mean, we have such a heavy backbeat. Let's just listen again and just focus in on that powerful like tambourine and snare sound we hear on every 2 and 4.
It's like the tambourine is the solo instrument.
Yeah, exactly. More, instead of more cowbells, more tambourine. They got this sound that it's so intense and driving. They got this by recording the tambourine part in what they called the Motown Echo Chamber, which was actually a hole in the bathroom.
Wait, okay. Quick story. I definitely once got to go into Westlake Music Studios where Michael Jackson recorded a bunch of his albums, and literally like the core thumb snaps that he uses on his tracks with Quincy Jones were done in a bathroom, and I definitely went in that bathroom and snapped my fingers and got a recording on my phone, and I will definitely play it for you.
That's great. Okay, so part of a long lineage of bathroom recording studios here.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Great reverb.
But that's how they got that effect that sounds almost like this thunderous backbeat kind of powering you through the song.
Hmm.
So we've got this like driving rhythm underneath, and then on top we have Martha Reeves' vocal. This was the second take of the song. The first take, she nailed it, apparently, but they hadn't pressed record.
Oh.
So the second take, she was a little peeved, and I think you can hear that in her vocals.
Yeah.
At certain points in the song, she puts a little anger into it that really drives it home.
That is fierce.
Yeah, just leaving it all on the floor.
I did gotta ask you though, like talking about leaving it all on the floor, at this point in recording technology, Are the entire band performing at the same time with the vocalist? Like, is this a live take?
Yeah, this is all happening live.
Ooh, wow.
There might be a few overdubs, like the tambourine, for instance.
Right.
But yeah, the band is mostly all playing live.
And so a lot of that big room sound we're getting, which was really popular in that era and obviously sort of known as the wall of sound, was that intentional or is that happening just because that's what it takes to record that many people and that much sound in that big of a room? So you get that in the background.
I guess that's kind of a chicken or egg question. Motown was definitely channeling the wall of sound production technique where you just have this sort of dense, unending texture of all these different orchestral instruments playing at once. You can hear that on tracks like The Crystals' Da Do Ron Ron.
Almost feels like it has this like jazz big band feel, right? Because there's just so many instruments filling a giant room with only probably a handful of mics capturing all the sound. So you're getting all that room noise and reverberation. I really particularly see it in my mind. I don't know if you saw the Beach Boys biopic Love and Mercy, but there were some really wonderful scenes of the recording of Pet Sounds, which uses a lot of that same sort of technique. And they're just in this big room, but everybody's just stuffed together around a few mics. Great reference and awesome movie to see.
Totally. You get the feeling of the excitement and the energy of the performance coming through your speakers 50 years later. But we've already dove into the musical aspect of what makes this song so effective. Let's kind of rewind and think about what the song is actually saying. In some ways, it's a very simple message. It's a summertime party anthem. Boys and girls get out and dance in the street. But there's also some very specific references going on. Like at points in the song, they call out different cities across the country. Chicago, New Orleans, New York City, Baltimore.
Such a classic way. It's a little bit of pandering, calling out every single city, but it works.
Yes, yes. And it's a technique. I wonder if they're not borrowing from a song that had come out a few years earlier, Night Train by James Brown, which similarly kind of goes through a musical atlas of the United States. Miami, Florida!
So I was totally wrong. I had called out sort of a proto-James Brown reference, but this is the era of James Brown, and they're definitely comping from it. It's great.
Yeah, and it's worth noting the cities they're naming here. Chicago, New Orleans, New York, Baltimore.
Yeah.
It's not, say, Salt Lake City or Portland, Maine. They are consciously broadcasting to African-American cities across the country, trying to connect with both their musical and, frankly, their economic audience. You know, these are the same cities that the Motown stars would go on tour. So they're trying to build that connection with their fans and their audience. So it's a wonderful, you know, musical choice to have these cities that you can picture as you're listening, but it's also a very calculated measure at the same time.
That this is a summer jam and that it's referencing all of these cities, encouraging people to go dance in the street, it definitely further reinforces this idea that I'm hearing this vamping and these beats that could be sampled and later used in the world of hip-hop, which started out in street parties in the summer.
Yeah. Okay. So you're talking about like the continuum of urban summer music history, I guess.
Yeah.
So we had the bathroom recording studio continuum, and now we have the summer dance party continuum. Cool.
Yes. Yes. Many continuums.
Yeah. And I love that image because the last thing I want to dig into here is the way this song gives you such a feeling of release that just makes you want to dance, that makes you want to party. And I think this is a very clever thing because it's all about the sense of stasis and then release.
Okay, great.
And that is all happening harmonically, Charles. It's all happening in the chord. So in order to hear it, we have to go back to the very beginning and we have to pay attention to where the harmony changes, the point where the underlying chords change from one to another.
Okay, cool.
Okay, so let's dim the music a little bit, and you and I can just keep talking, Charles.
Sounds good.
Because for as long as we're continuing to converse, we are listening to the same harmonic chord.
Right.
We're listening to the same bass tonic note.
It's just vamping over and over, the same thing.
Yeah, we're not going anywhere. We could just go on about any old subject in the world, you know, like I could ask you about your health. But then... Ah, okay, that was the moment. Now, all of a sudden, I'm not interested in whatever you had to say because we just exploded into a new harmony. Let's press pause. So what they're doing in Dancing in the Street is they're kind of lulling you into this single harmonic stasis point, and then they're waiting almost 40 seconds, an eternity in pop music time. I mean, glaciers are moving across the continent. The tectonic plates are breaking apart. I mean, eons is passing before we get a harmonic change. It's so unusual and it's so effective.
Yes.
Because every time you do get that move from the tonic to the subdominant.
Yeah, every time they do that, she says, there'll be sweet music everywhere.
Exactly. So music is the release. Music gives you that sense of ascension and transcendence.
Again, sort of like there's some like proto dance music quality here where, you know, in modern electronic music, oftentimes the sort of verse material will be fairly repetitive. So everyone's kind of doing the same dance move and like, all right, getting kind of bored, and then just at the right moment, it, you know, releases into a drop, and you have a whole new movement of energy. Everybody dances, takes on a new pose, and
yes.
I feel like this is doing the exact same thing, but
Whoa.
In a very different era of music.
Charlie, I love it. You are all about the diachronic perspective here. I love it.
I didn't know that I was diachronic, but thank you.
Continuums. Past is present, future is then, now is everywhere. I love it. And you will be pleased because after a short break, we are going to take this song into the future and see what became of it since its 1964 release.
Cool. Take me there.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Co-Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
When Dancing in the Street was released in 1964, it was an immediate hit.
Of course it was. Look at the name. It's its own apotheosis.
And one of the great signs of sort of the lasting effect of this song is how often it's been covered.
Yeah.
One of the first was from an unlikely source, the Mamas and the Papas. Let's just take a quick listen to their version of Dancing in the Street.
I don't know.
Very different approach, right? Very kind of sparse.
Oh, but really great payoff when they go into the music moment.
Yes.
Okay, so I think that the bass vamp here is really strange. They've altered it in a way which has like a twanginess to it. But there's some really great payoff with that awesome drum fill that leads into the chorus and that heightened moment. So it's even more reductive in the beginning and then pays off more in the end, a certain degree.
Yes. So this is a radical reinterpretation of the song. And this song just has even more in store for it, because if we fast forward to the ensuing decade, the 70s, we're going to find the Grateful Dead incorporating this into their epic free jam jazz exploration sets.
Well, this is totally appropriate considering everybody in Following the Dead is tailgating in the parking lots of stadiums, so they're all dancing in the street.
Yes, and beyond fitting the aesthetic of the Dead, this song actually helped open the whole musical approach of the band up to more free-form improvisation. It's the same thing we analyzed in the first half of the episode, I think, this sense of having this harmonic stasis for so long at the beginning of the song. That laid a groundwork for the band to improvise extended phrases and play off each other without having to worry about like getting harmonically dissonant, because there was just this underlying single harmonic structure.
But then when it explodes up into the other chord change, then it has a real great payoff in an awesome guitar solo, I imagine.
Yes, exactly. So there's those improvisatory peaks, and then you can sort of explode together back into the structure of the song. So it's very flexible in that way. So it's interesting. I think Dancing in the Streets played a not insignificant part in the Grateful Dead's evolution.
Interesting.
We zoom forward another decade and we find perhaps a pair of surprising covers of this song, one by the band Van Halen. Somehow managing to identify a hard rock hair metal aesthetic within the song.
Wow, that is frenetic.
I know.
It makes me realize that every single time someone says that you're coming out dancing to a brand new beat, the song is inviting reinterpretation because they can't play it the exact same way or else they're not meeting the promise of their cover.
Yes, I totally agree. But I think it's worth noting too that it's like this song somehow has a flexibility to be stretched into all these kind of different styles and still be effective.
Yeah.
There's something unique to its skeleton that somehow allows all these different interpretations to work, including one also from the 80s that was a huge hit by Mick Jagger and David Bowie. This was recorded for Live Aid, so they substituted cities around the world. This is a global Dancing in the Streets. So once again, in the capable hands of Jagger and Bowie, this song comes to life. It's surprisingly resilient, but in looking at all these covers, we're just looking at one side of the story, because Dancing in the Streets has another tale to tell as well. And that's as an unlikely protest anthem.
Oh, I had no idea. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, getting out in the streets and raising your voice.
Exactly. This song alighted from a party song when it was released in 1964 to, over the course of the increasingly fraught politics of the 60s, becoming this more almost militant anthem embraced by SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, during the 1960s. It was played during riots and protests in major American cities during 1966 and 1907. It was fully endorsed by these groups as an anthem of resilience and consolidation of the larger struggle.
Wow.
So this song was not just a party song. It was a political song.
I really love that this became a song of resilience at the same time, because there is an incredibly joyful experience of people marching and fighting for their rights, something which is, you know, fights for justice are overwhelmingly serious and important, and yet the experience of the community building that happens in those moments is also extremely special, and there is a celebratoriness in it. So I love that it contains both of those qualities.
Yes. No, Charlie, I think you've struck something too that's an interesting reminder, that music that accompanies protests isn't always angry or demanding. It's often an expression of collective joy.
Yeah.
And this song is a perfect example of that. I mean, it corresponds. So now, to return to your obsession with the continuum of past and present,
yeah,
you know, if we fast forward to some of the songs that have materialized as anthems for a current generation of civil rights protesters, of Black Lives Matter demonstrators, we'd find songs like "All Right" by Kendrick Lamar.
Right.
We gonna be all right.
Extremely upbeat song. I mean, very affirmational.
But then if we widened our lens even further, we'd find other surprising songs. You can watch videos made in war-torn regions like Yemen, shot by survivors literally amidst the debris of fallen buildings. And these videos, these compilations of people dancing, are all set to one song. Because I'm happy.
Get out of here. That's amazing.
Yes, Happy is another one of these unlikely anthems that maybe started as, you know, just a song, just the exploring the euphoria of momentary joy, and then somehow in these surprising situations became this anthemic glue to hold people together in times of crisis. So I think it's both these songs are reminders of how the politics of protest and the politics of joy can also and often collide.
In Happy, a lyric that could be read entirely differently, just like dancing in the streets could also be protesting in the streets. Here he says in Happy, clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. And in war-torn countries where literally people's homes are being taken away from them, it's, I mean, just stunning to think that this can be read in another way. But sort of this celebratoriness of still overcoming the human condition, even when you've lost your home.
Right, right. That's not just a metaphor anymore.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
So dancing in the street, this celebratory summer jam from 1964 has radiated out into our culture and frankly around the world, I think, in all these surprising ways that no one could have imagined when they were putting it together in one of the Motown studios in 1963. Marvin Gaye, Ivory Joe Hunter, Mickey Stevenson, Martha and the Vandellas cutting this track. It's stunning after, you know, hearing stories of playing the tambourine in the bathroom, what the destiny of this kind of humble summer splash slash commercial appeal to Motown fans has turned into.
Wow. Well, I really love what you've done here as well, because you've taken the idea of the Song of Summer, which, you know, kind of has this like really lighthearted sort of bubblegum quality, right? And yet expanded to show that the summertime is the time for communal gathering of all kinds, both of joy and struggle. And so that Songs of Summer might say something more than just let's have a party. I had never considered that before, and I really like that you've brought that here.
Thanks, man. And, you know, it comes back to that harmonic shift, I think, because that sense of release, that can...
Stasis to relief.
Yeah, I mean, that can take so many forms, like you said. It could be, like, where does the kind of joy of a party end and the joy of a, I don't know, political party begin?
Wow. Really cool.
Charlie, thanks so much for dipping back into the summer vault with me. We will be back in 2 weeks with another episode.
Nate lied. We'll be back again next week on Tuesday with our mini-series, The Fifth, accompanied by the New York Philharmonic. This is one of the most important pieces of music of all time, and whether you love classical or hate it, you know this work. But what you might not know is how it has fundamentally changed the way that we all listen to music, the way that we experience it, and the way that we divide ourselves through music. So, we'll be back next week with the beginning of our four-part mini-series. It's going to run 4 episodes over 2 weeks, every Tuesday and Friday. Check it out, starting September 8th. This rerun episode of Switched on Pop was produced by Nate Sloan and me, Charlie Harding, and it was edited by Bill Lance. Check us out on social media at Switched on Pop on Twitter and Instagram. We'll see you next week with The Fifth.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon, taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.